wandering in, it's pretty cold here in Milwaukee, and roads are a little bit funky, so we just start a little late and let people wander in. Welcome, thanks for coming. Today, Sean McDermott is the Chief Deputy Clerk here in the court. Shay Agston is Judge Helfinger's career law clerk, and Craig Stevenson from Madison are going to take us through the new forms. So we really appreciate their coming and preparing the outline, which is available online at our website under the Lou Jones Breakfast tab. Next month, February 9th is our date. We do not have a topic yet. So if you have an idea for a topic, we have some folks that have said, we're willing to help you out whenever you need speakers, but we need a topic. So if you have a topic, all you have to do is let Paula know, my judicial assistant, right? Everybody knows Paula. Just give her a call, shoot her an email, let her know, and we'll try to put together that topic. That's February 9th, so stay tuned to the Biker Listserv, and we'll let you know what that presentation is going to be. Again, thanks to Sean, Shay, and Craig, and take it away.
Good morning. We're happy to be here to present about the new bankruptcy forms. We wanted to thank Nicole Pellerin for allowing her to use part of our outline as something that she created for another presentation, and so we wanted to thank her for that. And then we're going to start out with Sean discussing sort of the first steps, the petition, and also the proof of claim form. And then I'll go through some of the new schedules A, B through G, and then Craig's going to finish that and also discuss the statement of financial affairs. Please, if at any time you have any questions, just feel free to interrupt and interject, and we'll try to take it from there.
Okay, thanks. Judge Kelly sent out an email yesterday in Biker. I hope everybody got it and was able to print out the forms. If you don't have them, we'll do our best to try and explain what we're talking about without you being able to look at them. But forms have been live now for a month and a half, so hopefully this isn't the first time you're hearing some of this information. This is the culmination of the 2008 project, the Forms Modernization Project. Schedules I and J were the first forms, and this is the recent forms update is the renumbering and reformatting of the remaining forms. So everything was updated. Like Shay said, we'll go through the major things. I'm going to start with the 341 notices and notice of bankruptcy filing. I won't go through them individually, just because these are court notices. I'll give you some highlights, some things that are different, but I won't bore you to death with going through each 309 form line by line. As preparation for this meeting, I did ask some of our case managers, like, what sort of filing errors are you seeing related to the new forms, and what sort of hang-ups are you seeing? And no one could really give me anything that they've noticed that's been a problem, so I guess that's great job to all of you in handling the forms update. So for the most part, the 341 notices were all updated in style and format. I think with the exception of the 7 and 11 non-individual cases, all of the dates and deadlines on those 341 notices have gone to page 2. So I think that's probably one of the biggest formatting changes that we saw, which is important to your clients. If, they get the first notice, they look at it, and they throw it away without going to page 2 to see some of the, at least the 341 meeting dates, some of the objection dates, and things like that. Another change that we made locally, if you look at like the 309A is the individual or joint debtor notice of bankruptcy filing, and the AO did not include non-filing spouse information fields in that form or any of the forms. So one of the local modifications that we made was forcing that information to appear in the debtor to field when applicable. We've just custom coded that, and you'll see it if there's a non-filing spouse. It'll specifically say non-filing spouse with that information, the full social security number when that goes out in the mail. Another thing to note that's different is the 309 notices now contain email address information specifically for attorneys. We had some problems implementing that for trustees because there's not any sort of reliable pattern that we can use as far as the trustees' primary and secondary email address, because a lot of them use Epic or BMC or some other data parsing service to parse out all of their filings. So we've eliminated that feature with the trustee. The trustee's email addresses will not appear on any of the 309 forms. However, all the attorney email addresses are going to pull from CMECF. So whatever your primary email address is in your filing account, that is going to appear on the attorney email contact field on the form. So it's typically on page one with the rest of the debtor information. So if you use some kind of generic email address for your notices and that's your primary email address, that's going to appear. And if no one's monitoring that because it's your kind of your holding place for all your filings, you might want to consider flipping your primary and secondary email address so a debtor or somebody else contacts you based off of this notice that you're actually receiving that email instead of it kind of going into your filing account. Any questions about that difference? No? Another thing to note is that 309B and 309C don't make a real, they're flipped. So the old B9C is now the 309B, and the old B9B is the new 309C. So if you are identifying those by their form numbers, those have kind of switched just to keep things better formatted. You will never see a 309B from this court unless we make a mistake, because we treat every individual Chapter 7 filing as a no asset case until the trustee files their notice of assets. So, but just something to note on that.
And if you want to see a conversion chart so that you can see the new numbers with the old numbers, there is a link on the outline that we provided on the website for a form conversion chart, so you can just quickly see, oh, I used to use a B22C. What is that, the new form, if you're looking for that resource?
The last thing about the 341 notices, if you have them in front of you and you go to 309F, what we've included in the attachment that we sent out was the AO version of the forms. We've modified this. This is the Chapter 11 Corporation 341. We've removed Section 8, which is the exception to discharge deadline, because it's not applicable. So that's been completely removed from our local form. Anything to add on any of the 341s?
No, although I did want to sort of go back to what Sean was saying about no one seems to be having any problems uploading the new form, so that's great. But one thing we are seeing is an increase in debtors filing their whole petitions and including their Social Security number in those petitions, either statements of Social Security numbers or in other pages of the form having a full Social Security number. So just as a reminder to scrub your forms, make sure there's nothing in there that's related to the full Social Security number, because if there is, then the court has to restrict that entire filing, which would be the entire petition. And we've just seen an increase for whatever reason in those events. So make sure to double check that. Make sure that your statement of Social Security number is separate and it's not being filed with the whole batch of documents that you're filing with your petition. Otherwise, you're going to get filing notice from the clerk's office, and I think a $25 fee to redact that petition, and then you'll have to refile it again without that information. So just a reminder about that.
Right. If you inadvertently do it, the clerk's office, case managers in the clerk's office are going to catch it, and that's great, because that's one of the things they're trained to catch is an inadvertent inclusion of that social. So if you have filed your petition, schedule, statement of affairs, means test form, everything together as one document, and on page 37 the debtor's Social Security number appears, that whole document is going to be restricted. We can't just restrict page 37. We have to restrict the whole thing. So then a notice, a deficiency notice, it's not mailed out, it's put on the docket. At least this is our current process, and we're talking about fixing it and maybe sending a document so that maybe that will jive people to act, is going to say your petition's been restricted because there's a social on page 37. You have 3 days
to file a motion to redact and pay the $25 fee. Otherwise, it gets referred to chambers and possibly your petition will be stricken, i.e. your case is dismissed. You don't want that to happen. So keep an eye out. If you make, everybody makes mistakes, we get that. But we try to warn you and try to, you know, alert you that this has happened. You can't just, oh, I'll just quick file an amended petition. That'll take care of it. No, you have to pay the $25. You have to file a motion. We're going to try to come up with a proposed form of motion that you can file so you don't have to panic and try to reinvent the wheel. So just, it is happening more often. I'm not sure why, but please pay attention to those notices that we put on the docket. Right, Sean?
Right.
And also, when you do file a motion to redact, make sure to remember that you will also need to file the redacted document. The clerk's office isn't going, even if you say, whoops, I made a mistake, page 37 has a social security number, maybe you caught it yourself, the clerk's office isn't going to go in there and line item your document. So you need to make sure that you file your redacted copy of the document so that you'll have something live on the docket, so that when your original entry is stricken, then you'll have something to replace it.
So that's kind of a good segue into moving on to the voluntary petition and some of those changes. One thing that hasn't changed is the form, which was the old Form 21. We've renumbered it to Local Form 121, but that is the same document that we've used in the past because the AAO didn't update the non-filing spouse information to add that field in the new national form. So we've updated that form. Now, if you're filing electronically, do not file the 121. You know, you're entering the Social Security number in CM. Most software is set up to exclude the Form 121, and if you can remember that, then you shouldn't run into any issues about redaction. But that process has not changed. So moving on to 101, and again, on the line 3 here, it does say only the last 4 digits of Social Security number, so there really isn't a good place to put the Social Security number if you're just entering the petition and not Form 121. But all this contact information obviously looks a lot different. There's a new header on all of the forms that's standard throughout the petition and the schedules. You can see they've removed reference to Chapter 9 and Chapter 15 on the individual voluntary petition. Information about business and where you live, that's all the same, but obviously it looks different. Line 6 replaces the venue box on page 2 of the old form, so asking if you if the debtor's lived in the district for the last 180 days. Part 2 is telling the court about the bankruptcy case. So again, there's 2 places to enter which chapter you're filing. So they've removed 15 and 9 from line 7. And one of the bigger changes is line 11, which is a question that asks, do you rent your residence? So in the past, this was a box on page 3 of the voluntary petition. Which is now replaced by forms 101A and 101B, which are statements about eviction and judgment. So in the past, we had like 3 or 4 check boxes and then the address of the landlord right on the voluntary petition. Now those are separate documents that you have to file. So the information is generally the same, but I think that what the forms attempt to do is to take the debtor's attorney through the process of what is required as far as the deposit with the court, the certification to the landlord, and the certification of the court that that's been served correctly. So it's a bigger, more extended process. I don't think the procedure has changed. The law has changed around the 362L, but it's now 2 additional forms, and we've created supplemental events to let you file those if you need to. So again, report about businesses as sole proprietor, that's all very similar information. That's just replacing some of those small boxes on page 1 of the petition. Part 4 replaces Exhibit C, which is information about hazardous property. And on the 201, on the non-individual form, this is a little bit expanded for businesses. It asks for some additional details about that property. Another one of the big changes is Part 5 replacing Exhibit D, so that's information about credit counseling. In the past, you file Exhibit D, which has, you know, the 3 check boxes, and then a space to explain any exigent circumstances that have cause the debtor to file without filing, without getting a briefing in credit counseling. One thing to note about Part 5 is it has a lot of questions about Debtor 1 and Debtor 2 and whether or not they've taken credit counseling, but it doesn't allow space to explain any of those exigent mm-hmm. circumstances. So to that effect, the court has created two new events. One is a statement regarding exigent circumstances, and two is a motion for waiver of the credit counseling requirement. So those are two new events, and Part 5 does talk about filing those two documents, but those are no longer contained in Exhibit D, and in the past the court has used those lines on Exhibit D to kind of allow a debtor to explain, you know, why they couldn't take credit counseling. Now we need additional forms.
Somewhere in there they should have defined exigent, because I have yet to meet a pro se debtor who knows
right.
what it means or bothers to look it up. Or at least give an
there
example.
There are instructions. One of the new things is there are instructions and committee notes on the, I don't know if the, in there it might explain what exigent is. I know we had a question come through the pro se coordinator, what does it mean to have a debt subject to set off? And I'm like, oh, that's got to be explained in the instructions. No, it isn't. So there are instructions. Do they define every word? No, but if you are stuck or maybe we're volunteering at the pro se help desk and trying to help somebody, look at those instructions. They might help you.
Right. And there are, right, like committee notes and form instructions on the national website that are a lot more detailed than the instructions on the petition itself. So you can link to all that information from our website. Statistical reporting, all that is pretty much the same. It's just a carryover from the original form, but it is, again, a little bit more organized and easier to follow. The other thing that's different is kind of this pro se warning, which is interesting. It kind of gives a pro se debtor one last chance at maybe going to the pro se help desk or calling an attorney to try and get some help. So it really does talk about bankruptcy fraud and the risks associated with filing bankruptcy without an attorney. So obviously the pro se problem is not just confined to the Milwaukee metro area. This is a national problem, so it's good to see that there's some proactive steps here. Again, I have 101A and 101B in the packet that we posted online. But again, those are just the replacement for the judgment eviction box on page 3 of the old petition. There's not a whole lot to mention about 201, which is the voluntary petition for non-individuals. They've eliminated a lot of the questions that apply to individual debtors that don't apply to non-individuals, so it's a little bit more streamlined. There's not duplication of information there. I think something new is a URL or a website for a business debtor, which they've added, and also some additional questions about, you know, like Chapter 11. That's all now in one confined spot, which is the, I think it's a small box on the front page of the old petition form. Now it's a little bit expanded with check boxes instead of just three lines. And again, I mentioned that the question about any property that it needs immediate attention is expanded for the business debtor. So.
And I saw something interesting about that. It now includes, so it used to be hazardous property or something that was a hazard to health or public safety. And now it asks, for example, do you own perishable goods or livestock that must be fed or a building that needs urgent repairs? And I thought that seemed to be a good idea if you have a farm case or you have a case that deals in perishable goods, that there's an immediate signal on the petition, which has to be filed on the first day of the case. It's not something that comes later, you know, 14 days with the schedules, and then you find out there's, you know, livestock needs to be fed, and I think I've heard at least one trustee say, if it needs to be fed, abandon it. So at least there's an immediate signal that there might be something here that needs immediate attention. I don't think that was part of any of the old forms, and because it's on the petition, it isn't going to be in the property schedules that may come 14 or even more days later. It's right up front on the petition so that, again, a trustee or a court, if there needs to be emergency motions, can deal with those things immediately out of the gate.
Yeah, I think that's the theme here with all of these changes is just all of the stakeholders in the bankruptcy process are going to be receiving more information about the debtor's property and assets and other liabilities. And so I don't know if you're like me, but I'm a little bit averse to change, and I love being able to just sort of scroll down. I know approximately halfway through my block of documents with the schedules, I'm going to find Schedule I and J. And so I know for me it's been a little bit of an adjustment trying to, you know, find those things again because I know where to look when I want certain things, and now everything's changed. But I think that once we get used to using these forms, we're all going to find that they're going to be better and more useful for everyone that's involved. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about Schedule AB. One of the big changes about the schedules is that they're separated between individuals and non-individual debtors, which is interesting and I think going to be useful because a lot of the questions that are not relevant to businesses and not relevant to individuals, vice versa, are removed and then separated so that those things can be focused on by the relevant debtors that need them. So Schedule AB, of course, merging former Schedule A, real property, former Schedule B, personal property. I'll start with Form 106. And again, you can look at the conversion schedules, but all of the individual forms start with a 1, so now they're 106 AB. All of the business non-individual forms are 2, so 206 AB and so on. So we're going to start with 106 AB. And I just want to note quickly also that previously Schedule B included a list of 35 groups of property and 4 columns in which to describe them. Those columns were none, description, location of property, husband, wife, joint, or community, and current value of the debtor's interest. And so now when you look at Schedule AB, you're getting a lot more information. It's not that any of this information wasn't required in the previous petition. Of course, it was. It's just that now there are a lot more triggers for people to, you know, think about it and provide information because it's set up more like a list and a checklist rather than a column where you can sort of miss or forget to, you know, add something or not add the detail that's now requested in these new forms. So, and also I think another interesting thing is there is no husband or wife anymore. You know, it's debtor one, debtor two, and they're called spouse. So obviously having to do with some of our changes in the law too. So everything's sort of being modernized. Now, Schedule AB Part 1 is for real property for individuals, and there is now a lot more information about property type. I know if you're like me, sometimes I've gone and thought, well, what is this property? Now it'll tell you, is it a single family home? Is it a duplex? Is it a condo, land, so on and so forth. So it's much more descriptive about what the property actually is. And also, there's no more requirement to list the secured debt on Schedule AB. I thought that was sometimes confusing to people previously because there'd be a list for the secured debt, and then you'd also have to list it on Schedule D. And so now it states right in here, do not deduct secured claims or exemptions. Put the amount of any secured claim on Schedule D, which I think makes sense. Let's just confine the information about secured creditors to the schedule that's devoted to secured creditors and not put that information in duplicate places. So Part 2 on Schedule AB is a description of vehicles, and that includes a cross-reference to Schedule G. So in case the debtor has a leasehold interest in a vehicle, it reminds the debtor, hey debtor, also include this in Schedule G because it's also a leasehold interest. So there's also, interestingly, a requirement to list the make, model, year, approximate mileage for the vehicle. And there's also a text box for other relevant information. So you can really get a better snapshot of what is this vehicle, you know, what's sort of the condition of it, looking right at the schedules. And it also requires, as did before, the valuation of an entire vehicle or any partial interest, if any. Question 4 is the same type of questions. If you have any aircraft or motorhomes, trailers, ATVs, or other vehicles and accessories. Part 3 is the personal and household items. Again, before there was just the household goods row and the columns to denote that. Now the categories, I think, are much more descriptive. They include both descriptions of the categories and also examples of these categories. So, for instance, if you look at sports and hobby equipment, someone might list it. It lists examples, bicycles, pool tables, golf clubs, skis, canoes, kayaks, musical instruments. You know, it just sort of triggers some people think, oh yeah, I have a, you know, trumpet that I inherited and, you know, those sorts of things to trigger them to list items there. Previous Schedule B, there was just a line item for animals. Now there is non-farm animals because there's an additional section in Part 6 where you would list farm animals. So that also, I think, is helpful. Part 4 discusses financial assets. There are two separate subsections to Part 4. The first asks if the debtor owns or has any legal or equitable interest in any of the following items, and then there are a whole bunch of questions. And then the second subsection asks about money or property owed to the debtor. This is not accounts receivable for a business, it's just money or property owed to the debtor, although I suppose if they were a sole proprietorship, that's probably where you would list that. But money and property owed to the debtor. And of course, all of these items were something that should have been included in the previous schedules, but I think it's just organized better, and there are a lot more triggers for people to remember, oh yeah, Uncle Jim owes me $500, and so I'll list that here, whereas they might not have thought about that before. There appear to be two new categories, bonds, mutual funds, or publicly traded stocks. That's question 18. And then claims against third parties, whether or not you filed a lawsuit or made a demand for payment. That's question 33. Again, these were always in the catch-alls, but now they're just sort of more specifically itemized.
And I thought it was interesting that they broke out annuities from other retirement accounts. I'm not quite sure why that was. I always think of annuities as usually being for retirement or maybe having something to do with life insurance, but they put it on a separate line all to its own instead of putting it under line 21 with IRA, ERISA, KEO, 401k, and then actually it says 403b, which is a tax-qualified annuity. Again, I looked at that and I thought, okay, that it is sort of something different than those, but it kind of fits in some of these other categories too. And again, I don't know, it's probably, I mean, in Wisconsin, our exemptions operate to cover certain types of financial assets, and so maybe that's why it caught my eye, whereas other states or it may not be categorized the same way. But it's just another nuance of the new forms that's there, and I don't know if it's confusing or not, but they broke it out there, whereas, you know, it could sort of fit under line 21 as well.
Right, and another interesting addition is line 24 talks about an account in a qualified ABLE program. And just so you are aware, you know, we're trying to go through the highlights of all the different forms, but the committee notes really do a great job of discussing the changes and why the changes were made and kind of giving you an explanation. One of the things in the committee notes is a reference to the qualified ABLE account and that a 2014 law now excludes them from property of the estate. So if you want more information about that, look at the committee note, and the reference is 26 U.S.C. Section 521 sub A sub B. Another thing that I thought was interesting is question 29, much more descriptive and discusses family support that might be owed to the debtor. So if there's a lump sum child support payment out there or alimony or some other spousal support, that can be included as well. Part 5 is business-related property. So again, business-related property that the individual owns because we have a whole other AB for non-individuals. Part 6 is farm or fishing-related property, and here's where you list your farm animals, not in Part 3, but in Part 6. So I'm going to switch over now to Schedule AB for non-individuals. There's really a different organization, which I was surprised about. I thought maybe they would mirror each other, and they don't at all. You would expect the non-individual AB to start with real property, but it doesn't. The instructions are much more detailed and tailored to business entities. It instructs the debtor to include all property, real and personal, in which the debtor holds rights and powers exercisable for the debtor's benefit, including assets and properties that have no book value, such as fully depreciated assets or assets that were not capitalized. Part 1 relates to cash and cash equivalents. Part 2 is deposits or prepayments. Part 3 is accounts receivable. This includes a much more detailed description of accounts, the accounts that are under 90 days, the accounts that are over 90 days, and then it asks the debtor to deduct the amount that the debtor estimates are uncollectible or questionable collectability so that you can arrive at a total for those accounts receivable. Part 4 is a list of investments, including mutual funds or public stocks, not otherwise listed in Section 1, which is cash or cash equivalent. And then it also includes non-public stocks and interest in a business, with a requirement to list the percentage of the ownership, which I thought was interesting. Previously, if you wanted to know a percentage of an ownership interest, you had to go to the SOFA, and you would only know what the percentage was or even that it was listed if it was more than 5%. Of course, you still would have listed an interest in a business on Schedule B if it was less than 5%, but now you have everything sort of right there in the same piece, which I think is more efficient for the reader. Part 4 is a list of investments, including mutual funds or public stocks, that are not included in Section 1. Part 5 discusses inventory, excluding agricultural assets. So this is much more detailed. It requires something that looks much more like a borrowing base that the debtor's bank would require. Raw materials, work in progress, finished goods, and other inventory is listed there. Also requires a disclosure, again, if inventory is perishable or if any inventory was purchased within 20 days of filing. And of course, that relates back to, you know, do we have any potential 503B9 claims? So that's interesting and useful information. It also starts with a requirement that flows through this document requiring a disclosure of any appraisals of the property that have incurred within the past year. Part 6 is farm and fishing related assets. Much more detailed, again, balance sheet approach. Debtors required to list net book value when available and the valuation method used for the current value as well as the current value. And it also requires disclosure of any property purchased within 20 days and whether there's a depreciation schedule or an appraisal that's been conducted within the past year. Part 7, again, we still haven't got to real property. Part 7 is office furniture and collectibles. Part 8 is machinery, equipment, and vehicles. This requires a more detailed disclosure than the individual vehicle disclosure. It requires the year, make, model, VIN or HIN number, net book value of the debtor's interest, if available, and the valuation method used, along with the current value of the debtor's interest. It also requests any depreciation schedules or appraisals within the last year. Finally, in Part 9, we get to real property, and it's a description that's similar to individuals, but it's organized much differently. And it requires a valuation method. It also asks for the depreciation schedules, and it also asks if there's been an appraisal in the past year. Part 10 is intangibles and intellectual property, including goodwill section now. You can value, you know, the goodwill of the business, as well as licenses, internet domains, or websites. And then Part 11 is a catch-all for any other assets. I'll just quickly move into Schedule C. Schedule C, of course, does not have two.
Let me just interrupt before you go there. So this schedule, the schedules for the non-individuals, this is for not only Chapter 11s and all this stuff. Yeah, that's great in Chapter 11, but if you're thinking about putting a Chapter 7 corporation or a corporation into a Chapter 7, you have to file all this stuff. So you really have to ask yourself, really? What am I doing putting a corporation into Chapter 7? Doesn't get a discharge. I mean, there's obviously reasons for it, but just so you're aware, this isn't just for Chapter 11. This schedule with all this information would have to be filed if you put that corporation in Chapter 7.
That's correct, and it would also, of course, apply to a Chapter 12 business as well.
And the other question I have is, and you might not know this, there's this corporate ownership form that you need to file. Is that, you still need to file that?
I believe so, yeah. Disclosing if you had a 5% or more interest.
Right. The corporate ownership form talks about who are the owners of the debtor. I think it's for
recusal.
To making sure the judge doesn't have a conflict of interest.
Yes.
That's not included in here, so you still have to file that form, Sean?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So
what about a copy of the corporate resolution? That, because usually you see those that authorize the filing
right.
of a bankruptcy. Is that someplace else? No.
I don't know. I'm used to obtaining that and putting it in the file and then having the authorized signature sign the petition, but it always comes up at the 341 meeting. The U.S. trustee or somebody is asking, I need to see the resolution of the right people that
mm-hmm.
authorized
right.
the
filing. We often see those filed. Those filed.
Yeah, with the petition.
Right. Yeah, and I do too in Chapter 11 corporate cases. I think I don't know if it's a requirement or not offhand. I know it's something you have to obtain to have
mm-hmm.
the authorization, but I don't know. I mean, if you can file it, you should, because people will certainly ask to see it at some point in the case.
Okay.
We certainly require the corporate ownership statement as part of the deficiency process, but the corporate resolution we typically look for and
okay.
issue a deficiency.
In an individual case where they also have a sole proprietorship, would you anticipate 106 and 206 then?
No.
No. So even if they've got a fairly complex sole proprietorship that has all these things, we would still just do 106?
The question is, if there is a debtor that's an individual but operates a sole proprietorship, would you expect them to file both a 106 AAB or, you know, and 206 of any of the schedules? And I think my answer would be no, because if they're an individual, even though they're operating a sole proprietorship, they're not a non-individual, and so they wouldn't need to file the 206.
Well, most often those individuals really aren't sole proprietors, they're LLCs. They have an LLC with a single member. So what do they file then? They're filing as an individual, but they have that individual has a single member LLC.
Well, my practice is to list the LLC interest under the, you know, non-publicly traded company, the percentage of it, and then attach a balance sheet and say, see, you know, I'll value the company.
Never seen one.
And then I attach that to Schedule B, and then I have the detailed balance sheet. By the way, when I say balance sheet, I think you have to be careful. It probably shouldn't always be the one that is printed out from the accountant's office, because you have book values and that may not fairly reflect the value of the assets and the liabilities in the company. But I attach what I call the balance sheet, which is to reflect internal to the LLC its assets and its liabilities, its net value, and then if it's less than 100%, the percentage interest that the debtor owns. So that number appears and not much else, but I don't see those. And I do that in every case where the debtor, individual debtor, owns a significant interest in an entity or 100% interest, but I don't think the assets of the LLC go in the individual debtor's schedules. They own the interest, the LLC owns the assets.
That's right.
So that's how I break it down when I do mine.
And if you're using an accountant's balance sheet, you got to be real careful, because those are usually cash basis and they don't reflect receivables and things like that.
And the comment was, if you're using an accountant's balance sheet, you have to be careful because it's usually on a cash basis, and so you want to make sure that it's listing everything you need to.
Yeah, and I always, an accountant's balance sheet is a good starting point, but you have to move on from there and ask questions, and if things have been depreciated down to zero and they could be sold for something, you can't just throw that on there and say that's the end of it. So, you know, fair warning that you can't just rely on that, but that's kind of a starting point for doing it.
Well, I just want to quickly move through Schedule C. Of course, there are no non-individual Schedule Cs. It's been revamped. It's much more descriptive, and it asks whether the exemptions are federal and state rather than just referencing the code section numbers 522, B2, and B3. And Section 2 reminds the debtor that anything listed on Schedule C must have also been listed on AB, so there's a good cross-check there. And then also looking at Schedule D.
Isn't a big change that you now get to pick 100% of fair market value up to any applicable statutory limit?
Yes.
I think that's a big change.
Yes.
In the exemption schedules.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The debtor is still required to list the specific subsections permitting each exemption, but you of course have that reference as well. Schedule D, there are now two different Schedule Ds, again, one for an individual, one for an entity. The individual has much... The one for the individual is 106D, much better organization, but the same basic information. Non-individual debtors form 206D. It requires more information on the individual debtors, including the creditor's email, if known, whether the creditor is an insider or related party, and whether multiple creditors have an interest in the same property. I think this is very interesting because if the answer is yes, it forces the debtor to list the creditor and its, quote, relative priority. I don't know how many debtors actually know what the priority status is of liens that are, you know, multiple liens on the same property. And it sort of also forces them to take a position about that. Not that, you know, that's a legal determination, but still, it's some interest, some information about what the debtor believes the relative priority of that security interest is. And part two also has others to be notified, including attorneys for secured creditors. So I know a lot of you do the listing someone for notice purposes only. Now you can list them on the second section for notice purposes only. And then for individual debtors, now schedules E and F have been combined to EF. So all unsecured claims are in one schedule, obviously priority and non-priority. There are separate ones for individuals and for entities. and they're broken up, part one, priority claims, part two, non-priority claims, and part three, others to be notified. So that's with respect to the individuals. For non-individuals, part one removes the categories that are only applicable to individuals, for example, a DSO debt, and it adds a requirement to specify a specific priority code section whether the claim is subject to an offset. Schedule G for individuals, question one is now clear that even if the debtor doesn't have any unexpired leases or executory contracts, they should still check the box and still file the Schedule G. There's a better description of the types of items that should be disclosed, example, rent, vehicle lease, or a cell phone. And for non-individuals, Schedule G is more detailed and requires a description of the debtor's interest in the lease or the contract. So now we're going to turn over to Craig Schedule H, I forgot Schedule H. For individual debtors, there is a co-debtor form for Schedule H, and strangely removes Alaska from the list of community property states. So something changed in Alaska. So if you have anyone who's coming,
it was always elective.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yes.
so now they're removed from that.
Not automatic.
Which is something I noticed. So, and then I'll turn it over for Craig for Schedule H and G.
So Schedule H, regarding the co-debtors, they've added the question that I think we're used to seeing on the statement of affairs about whether within the last 8 years you've lived in a community property state. So they've connected the dots between living in a community property state and having a co-debtor spouse, potentially, if it's a non-filing spouse. But there's a specific instruction that don't include your spouse as a co-debtor if your spouse is filing with you, which may just add confusion. But just be aware that that question is on Schedule H now, and if you have a non-filing spouse, and we live in Wisconsin, which I guess is a community property state, we call it marital property, but it triggers this notion that your non-filing spouse should be listed as a co-debtor for most, if not all, the debts. And again, you have to look at marital property agreements and things like that to determine that. Also, I noticed in the official instructions to Schedule H, and this probably isn't as applicable in Wisconsin, but it tells you to list the non-filing spouse where any of the debts are for necessities. So that would be food or medical care, or a couple examples. Again, I think we're used to treating most debts between spouses as being a co-debtor situation. But again, the official instructions are, in some regards, quite detailed and informative for things to think about when filling out these schedules. In the interest of time, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Schedules I and J, because by now we've seen those for quite some time. I and J, as was noted earlier in the program, were the first schedules to be updated to reflect this forms modernization project. And so I think most people who've been filing cases are familiar with the new I and J, their new formats and organization. The recent update, though, adds Schedule J2. Schedule J2 is expenses for a separate household. So if debtor 2 or debtor 1 has a separate household, debtor 2 can list the separate household expenses and other details of the second household on Schedule J2. And I think, as far as I can recall, my software would give me that option to have sort of an addendum to Schedule J, and I think the Forms Modernization Project has sort of picked up that there needs to be a separate designation for a separate household as far as Schedule J. So now I want to talk about the Statement of Financial Affairs. And as with Schedule B, it's been completely sort of taken apart and put back together. And so that if you're used to rattling off certain things belong in SOFA 3 or transfers on SOFA 10, just forget it. It's all been changed. Again, it will take some getting used to, I'm sure, and in the not too distant future we'll all have the new lines down. But I just sat for a 341 meeting yesterday for the first case I filed, and every time the trustee was asking something as I was trying to follow along, it was taking me some time to find where things were on the schedules, and so it's just something I assume we're going to have to get used to as we adopt these new forms. So the first thing I wanted to note is the sources of income portion, which is part two of the Statement of Affairs. This has changed a little bit. Again, I think the forms, while I think they're a little bit, they flow a little bit easier, there seems to be a little bit less room or sort of things are kind of compacted. Now, the software, if you use software, kind of helps you deal with that. But there is no place in the new statement of affairs to itemize different sources of income. It just asks you to check a box if it's wages, commissions, bonuses, or tips, or from operating a business. Then it asks you to give a number. And it doesn't really give you a line to say this is, you know, if some people have changed jobs or have more than one job simultaneously in a given time period here, it may be difficult to itemize that out. I think you may be able to find it in your software. You can do that. But again, I think trustees, to some extent the United States trustee, are still going to want that information. So I don't know if it's going to require adding lines or adding information to it, or at least having that information ready, whether it's in the form of W-2s or recent pay stubs in your file at the 341 meeting, so that it can be produced. But it doesn't show up as clearly on the form as I think it used to. Skipping ahead a little bit, in Part 3, again, debtors are asked to list certain payments made before filing bankruptcy. So again, this is to alert the trustee or other constituents of the case as to potential preferences. And I noted that line 8 asks if within 1 year before you filed, you made any payments or transfers on account of a debt that benefited an insider, which is a little bit different than the line right above it, which is a payment on a debt you owed to an insider. And I think the old form said to or for the benefit. Now that's been broken apart. Okay, I know if I pay a debt to an insider within a year, potential preference. But by breaking this out, I think they've alerted debtors' counsel to kind of the sneaky insider preference, which is, you know, you have a cosigner on a debt, a large payment is made, of course, that benefits the non-filing co-debtor. And if that person is an insider of the debtor, the trustee could potentially have a clawback action against the person, not against the bank to whom the payment was made, but against the insider who may have benefited from that. In the Western District, we refer to that as a hauling preference. I assume that is next to meaningless here. That was a Judge Utchick case that was early in the jurisprudence of this type of recovery. The code has evolved a little bit since then, but basically, I think this is sort of a big red flag that, oh, okay, I have to remember to think about, do I have insider co-debtors? Were payments made to the principal creditor, and did that benefit the insider? If it did, maybe I need to pause and consider the impact on the non-filing co-debtor in that event. a couple other changes. In Part 4, they've consolidated the questions regarding legal actions and assignments that used to come under SOFAs 4, 5, 6, and 13, so where we're talking about lawsuits, court actions, and property repossessed, foreclosed, garnished, attached, seized, or levied. Again, it's just a formatting change, I think, that improves, in my opinion, the organization here and puts sort of logical things, the lawsuits, and then the actions that typically flow from lawsuits, like captures of debtors' property and money pre-petition. Part 5, we have gifts and contributions. They changed the number here. It used to be $100 or $200, depending on to whom the gift was made. Now they're asking if within 2 years did your gift's total value more than $600. And I thought, why $600 now? And I can't figure it out. It's a completely arbitrary number, because if you give a gift, it's not a preference. And so I don't know where $600 comes from. Maybe that's something that the people thought, well, if it's less than $600, trustees aren't likely to chase it. I don't know, but there's no minimum amount under 548 to claw back a gift for no consideration from a recipient. So I don't know why they changed it to $600, but they did. So when you're filling it out, just be aware that the number is different than under the old form. Part 7, this is where you list certain payments or transfers pre-petition. And again, within a year before you filed, did you or anyone else acting on your behalf transfer anyone seeking where you consulted about bankruptcy or preparing a bankruptcy petition? Again, that's not that different, but again, it's did you transfer anything to anyone who helped you with the bankruptcy petition? It's a little more expansive than paying. And then, of course, the typical line 18, within the 2 years, did you sell, trade, or otherwise transfer any property to anyone other than in the ordinary course of business or financial affairs? Again, just looking for assets that were transferred, similar to the old SOFA 10. And then we have the next question, which is the 10-year look back for self-settled trusts. And it asks, did you transfer any property to a self-settled trust or similar device of which you are a beneficiary? And then I thought the parenthetical was interesting. These are often called asset protection devices. And I'm not sure that those types of transfers are limited to just asset protection devices. Certainly, asset protection devices might fit within the definition of a self-settled trust, but there could be other self-settled trusts that are not necessarily asset protection devices. But the parenthetical there, I assume, is there as guidance to help people identify these assets as they're answering the questions. The last part of the statement of affairs asks details about your business or connections to any business. And again, this has been cleared up a little bit. I remember going through old statement of affairs 18 through 25, which is what Part 11 sort of replaces. And there were several questions that began with, if the debtor is a corporation, partnership, or limited liability company, or something to that effect. And no matter how many times I did this, I had to read through and remember which ones didn't apply to my individual debtors and which ones applied to my non-individual debtors. Now, as with the other forms, we have two completely separate sets of statement of financial affairs questions, and they have tailored each set to the type of debtor that's filing. So when you get to Part 11, you no longer have to parse, okay, does this apply to my individual debtor or not? So I think that, again, it makes it a little cleaner, a little better, but you can assume, because you understand statement of affairs in an individual case, that it mirrors it in a non-individual case. You have to, again, kind of relearn the forms as you go, because they're not different for the different types of debtors. One thing I also wanted to point out is the signature lines, and this is true of the petition as well, they changed the wording of the signature lines ever so slightly when you're asked to make declarations in bankruptcy. It used to be that the signature line said that, to the best of my knowledge, information, and belief, thus and such is true. That's not in the language for the signature lines anymore. The new declaration says, I've examined the petition, if it's the petition, and I declare under penalty of perjury that the information provided is true and correct. It doesn't say, to the best of my knowledge, information, and belief. And I think that's an important change. First of all, the change was made to comport with part of the judicial code that says if you submit something in a federal judiciary proceeding, it has to say that. That's 28 U.S.C. 1746. But I guess if anybody was filing and think that best of my knowledge, information, and belief language left them some wiggle room, they've taken it out. So I hope not too many people were relying on that. But it's gone from the new forms, and I think that, again, it's an alert to debtors' counsel and to debtors, perhaps if they're unrepresented, that you better be pretty darn sure after a thorough inquiry that what's being submitted is correct, and that best of knowledge, information, and belief may not cut it anymore with the new forms.
About 2 minutes, Greg?
Okay, I'll finish up because we got just a couple differences on the non-individual statement of affairs. Again, it's just a different look, different form, because the questions are different. For example, in asking about preference transfers, the threshold is just 6225, because of course that's the only one that applies to non-individuals who don't have any consumer debts. With respect to charitable contributions, part four. Again, they ask about charitable contributions for those gifts over $1,000. Again, it's one of those numbers where I can't find it in the code or the rules anywhere. It just seems like it's a practical threshold that they've picked to not introduce more information into the forms than is practically necessary or useful. And then another new part, Part 9, asks these corporate or non-individual debtors to list personally identifiable information. Does the debtor collect and retain personally identifiable information of customers? This was an important issue in the Radio Shack case, and it has been in a couple other cases for retailers that collected vast amounts of consumer data and a privacy ombudsman was appointed to protect the consumers, and state's attorney generals were filing actions in the bankruptcy. Again, I don't believe that there was anything about that specific category in the old statement of affairs. Now it's here to be placed front and center in the schedules so that, again, interested constituents, state's attorney generals, privacy advocates know right away, okay, this debtor has some customer lists or telephone numbers and addresses of people that may not want it to be sold to third parties that may deal with it less responsibly than the debtor did pre-petition, and so that's a new addition to the non-individual statement of affairs.
I want to thank these guys for put them on the spot. Maybe in about 6 months after we've all kind of been using these things, we'll have you back and find out what are some of the issues and questions and problems that people are having. So I really appreciate it. Judge McGarrett, you would like to
I'll come over here so I can get on camera. Anybody who didn't get a flyer for my retirement party, pick one up back there. Those of you who are around the state, if you really want to come to Milwaukee in February 2nd, and you didn't get one, you didn't hear about it all day, everybody's welcome. February 2nd from like 11 to 4, like an open house, only it's an open court. So all are welcome.
Great, and then come back on February 9th, I believe is our date, for our next Blue Jones, and stay tuned to Biker for what the topic is. If you have one to suggest, please do, and we'll try to find some great speakers like these to present it to you. Thanks again. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.